The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Even before graduating second in her class from the University of Texas, El Paso, with a bachelor's degree in geology in May of 1986, 34-year-old Lyndon Kaufman Leanham was a very successful and very busy woman. For more than 9 years, she had worked as an engineer for the Southern Pacific Railroad. As she earned her bachelor's degree, Lyndon was a scuba teacher and member of the Professional Association of Diving Instructors and a member of the Interspace Divers of El Paso. Because her husband, Patrick, understood Lyndon's passion for the sea as a master diving instructor himself, he supported her decision to move into an apartment in College Station so she could attend Texas A&M University's Graduate School of Oceanography. Lyndon began taking classes for her master's degree the fall semester of 1986 after securing a small apartment off Kane Road, just a little over a mile off campus. As the semester's final exams loomed, however, Lyndon's life was cut short by a cowardly man determined to make his way through life, riding the back of others' hard work and determination. 23-year-old Malcolm Trent Primrose was a boy local to the Brazos Valley and Gulf Coastal Plain regions of Texas. He'd been unable to cut it as a university student. He dropped out around 1984 and began working as a roughneck. Primrose stuck around College Station and Bryan, bouncing around the spare bedrooms and sofas of area friends. Much like his inability to meet the intellectual challenges at Texas A&M, Primrose couldn't quite handle the laborious and tiring work the oil fields demanded. By the fall of 1986, he was unemployed and apparently refusing to seek an even somewhat honest living. On Tuesday, November 25th, 1986, at 6 a.m., Malcolm Trent Primrose lifted the unlocked screen on the window of an apartment on Kane Road, down the street from where he was staying with a friend. He made his way through, and once in the unit's living room, he began stuffing his bag with anything and everything that looked like it might catch a few bucks at an out-of-town pawn shop. Suddenly, a woman walked in and began yelling at Primrose. Unlike the cowardly burglar, the woman, though presumably fearful, was brave. She began physically fighting the man just after he pulled a short length of rope from his pocket. For a while, she held her own, but Primrose eventually overpowered the woman, and soon the rope was around her neck. The intruder squeezed tight until she no longer struggled. Lyndon Kaufman Leanham's promising life was over. Though the sun hadn't yet risen, on the eastern horizon its rays shot through the otherwise starry morning sky. If he was going to leave the apartment without being seen, Primrose thought, it had better be now, and quick. He left the spoils behind. For the rest of the day, the young man who'd gone from burglar to murderer in a matter of minutes stayed inside his friend's house. Between 7:30 and 8 p.m., when the sun had fully retreated, leaving a half moon the brightest source of light, Malcolm Trent Primrose made his way back to the crime scene to collect the items he had originally planned to steal, and then some. Though an attempt to comprehend this violent criminal's thinking process would undoubtedly prove futile for anyone who values life, when he returned and bound the wrists and ankles of Lyndon's lifeless body, it was likely to make it easier to carry her away. That was Primrose's plan, to dump Lyndon in some remote area, a plan that was thwarted when, as he collected her valuables, the woman's friend entered the apartment through the back door. The thief killer quickly bolted out the front and sprinted to a nearby and small wooded area, where he waited out the night as College Station policemen investigated the scene of Lyndon's murder. Primrose later denied sexually assaulting Lyndon, and it's unclear whether there was any evidence he had. After stealing a truck that day from an area grocery store parking lot, Primrose headed out of state, using Lyndon Kaufman Lenham's credit cards along the way. A Benton, Arkansas patrolman found Primrose asleep in the stolen truck at a rest stop off Interstate 30. Items belonging to Lyndon, her identification, credit cards, jewelry, and even her pistol, were discovered in the vehicle. Malcolm Trent Primrose confessed to the murder almost immediately upon his arrest. Before he was apprehended, and perhaps for a short period after, police in Austin, Texas, theorized that Lyndon Kaufman Lenham's slaying might be connected to one of their cases that shared several similarities, the murder of Connie Bibb 2 days later. Connie Jane Bibb was born on May 26, 1958, in Spokane, Washington, to parents Carl and Genevieve. Carl Bibb was a major in the Air Force and was, in fact, on the Special Aerospace Rescue and Recovery Service task force that picked up Apollo 8 in the Pacific Ocean when it returned to Earth on December 27, 1968, after orbiting the moon. Connie's family, which included a brother and sister, lived in Honolulu, Hawaii for several years, but Connie mostly grew up in Plano, Texas. Her extended family had gotten bigger after her parents divorced. Her father went on to have another daughter, Connie's half-sister, and she had several stepbrothers. After graduating Plano High School in 1976, she followed in her father's footsteps and joined the Air Force, though she'd not go on to a lifelong military career like he had. While stationed on a base in Germany, Connie learned and mastered repairing ground radio communication equipment. She served her 4 years and left the military as an airman first class in communications. Once back in the States, Connie lived in Reno with her mother and stepfather. While attending the University of Nevada, she took a job as a dealer at Harrah's Hotel and Casino in Reno. In 1983, Connie returned to Texas, this time Austin, and began taking classes at the University of Texas, but she kept close contact with her family in Reno through letters and phone calls. Tragically, her father, Major Carl Bibb, died that year, and 3 years later, in 1986, her brother Kurt died at only 26 years old. In the fall of 1986, Connie Jane Bibb entered her senior year at UT, her major, special education. She was a devout Christian and planned to become both a teacher and a missionary. Connie worshipped at Maranatha Christian Church, a couple miles north of the home she shared with 9 other women, some students at the university, and some evangelists. She had moved into the house at 2807 Hemp Hill Park just as her senior year at the University of Texas began, and she was elated to be living with so many of her friends, nearly all of whom were fellow members at her church, where Connie had been going for more than 2 years. The North University neighborhood in which she lived was a prime spot if you were a student. Not only was it a short distance to class for Connie and her roommates, the drag was also less than a mile away, one of the best spots in Austin to grab a burger and shake or do a little shopping. The house was also just south of the Hyde Park neighborhood, a very desirable place to live. But because the cops had kept mum about a series of sexual assaults there, no one knew Hyde Park was a dangerous place to be. In November of 1986, only the residents who had survived the Hyde Park rapists' attacks and their closest friends knew of him. Over the course of this devil's reign of terror, only a few survivors reported the assaults they endured to police, but it's been theorized the Hyde Park rapist is responsible for the sexual assaults of dozens of women in the North Austin neighborhood for which he's named. The first known attack occurred on January 17, 1986, though the brazen confidence and seemingly meticulously planned assault suggested the rapist had done his worst several times before. That night, a nurse returned to her apartment in the detached garage of one of the many craftsman homes in Hyde Park after a date. She was her usual confident and jovial self as she turned the key in the lock. But after opening the door, she'd never be the same again. The nurse was immediately accosted by a stranger claiming to wield a gun, his face obscured by the darkness. She was gagged, blindfolded, bound with nylon cord, and commanded to comply with the man's demands, both before and as he raped her. After the armed stranger fled, the nurse reported the assault to police. Almost a year later, on Thursday, November 27, 1986, Connie Jane Bibb ate Thanksgiving dinner at a friend's house. It's been reported that Connie ate Thanksgiving dinner and returned at about 7 p.m., and although she had plans to visit another friend, she did not, for reasons unknown. It is unclear if that report is correct, but to further confuse the events of that day, another report has Connie coming home at 6:30 p.m. and was phoning relatives when one of her roommates came home and changed clothes before heading to the football game. Since that game started at 7:20 p.m., the third conflicting report that Connie left her friends at around 8:30 p.m., stopped at another friend's house for a quick visit, and arrived home between 8:45 and 9 p.m. is likely incorrect. The cold drizzle that night, anyway, didn't keep Connie's friends and roommates from cheering on the Longhorns, who ended up being trampled by the Aggies that night. But perhaps it was the weather that kept her in. Whatever the case, Connie Bibb had the house to herself. At 10 p.m., one of her roommates returned home and found the 28-year-old woman dead. When Austin police officers arrived at 2807 Hemphill Park, they quickly ascertained that an intruder had jimmied open the second-story patio door at the back of the house. Once inside, he made his way downstairs, where he either surprised or was confronted by Connie in the hallway. Judging by the scene, damage to the floor and walls, there was a violent struggle. Connie was knocked unconscious at some point during the fight, and the intruder tied a pair of pantyhose tightly around her neck and knotted it from behind. A scarf was stuffed into her mouth and also tied in the back. Detectives couldn't explain what was perhaps the oddest detail of the murder. Connie's killer had doused her abdomen and chest with perfume. The bottle was never found. Austin Police Sergeant Juan Gonzalez called the detail some kind of quirk the killer has. Travis County Medical Examiner Dr. Roberto Bayardo determined the cause of death to be asphyxiation from strangling and gagging. Connie Jane Bibb, Dr. Bayardo said, had been dead about 2 hours before her body was discovered. He cited bruises and scrapes to the arms and legs as further evidence she'd fought her killer vigorously. Connie was found fully clothed, and no evidence of sexual assault or attempted sexual assault could be found, the medical examiner said at the time. though months later, details emerged that suggested some type of sexual assault actually had occurred. Nothing was stolen from the house. Due to these reported details, detectives could only speculate a motive. And despite those same details, it was theorized that the killer either planned to burglarize the home or rape Connie, but she fought so hard, he left without going through with his intended crime. Connie's roommates were all interviewed, and detectives quickly obtained the phone records to see if anyone she'd spoken with might be responsible. Inside the home, they searched for fingerprints, and outside, for boot or shoe impressions. Police immediately cordoned off an area adjacent to the house, where, they said, transients often loiter. But area homeowners and property managers told the Austin American-Statesman newspaper that the area's transients and homeless were harmless. One apartment manager told police that a female at one of his properties, directly across the street from Connie's house, had reported a suspicious person parked in a car there for several hours at 1:30 a.m. a couple days earlier. The woman waited for police to arrive, but finally went to bed after waiting for more than an hour. A patrolman eventually arrived, but could find no such vehicle, meaning the car left before he got there. Police spokesman C.F. Adams blew off the possibility of a connection between the suspicious car and Connie Bibb's murder. In the area surrounding the University of Texas, he said, the department gets a lot of suspicious person calls. Friends and relatives told police they had no idea who would attack Connie. It was senseless, they said. The cops couldn't come up with a suspect. Austin Police Homicide Sergeant Hector Reveles phoned the Texas Department of Public Safety and requested the help of Sergeant Ed Richards, a suspect profiler. Newspersons asked Sergeant Reveles if detectives were investigating murders in other cities for possible connections, and they certainly were, particularly the murder of Texas A&M student Lyndon Kaufman Lenham 2 days before. Spokesman Adams said Lyndon's death was a base they intended to cover. Though he said he preferred not to use the term serial killer, Adams did anyway when he said it was possible they were dealing with a killer who'd come from College Station. The slaying of Lyndon Kaufman Lenham, however, had no connection to the murder of Connie Jane Bibb, detectives eventually learned. By month's end, the cops announced they were looking for a specific individual who'd been seen in the area around Connie's house. Several hours before her murder, detectives said, he'd been seen walking through a rear alley a couple houses down from the murder scene, and then hanging around the general area. The person was described as a light-complexioned Latino or dark-complexioned Anglo, about 5 feet 11 inches tall, and dirty, transient-looking, police spokesman C.F. Adams said. He may be a suspect, Adams went on, or he might have seen the suspect.
He may have some information that can help us.
A composite sketch of the man was reportedly drawn, but, it appears, never released. Memorial services for 28-year-old Connie Jane Bibb were held in Texas at the Austin Peel and Son Funeral Home on Monday, December 1, 1986, and then in Reno, Nevada, the following Saturday at the Walton Funeral Home. She was buried at Our Mother of Sorrows Cemetery in Reno. Meanwhile, more than a week after the murder, Austin Police Homicide Sergeant Juan Gonzalez commented that while he and other detectives had no shortage of persons of interest to check out, they were no closer to an arrest than they were day one. But weeks into the investigation, detectives later said, a suspect emerged that warranted a close look. On Friday, March 7, 1987, A Travis County judge signed off on a search warrant to obtain blood, hair, and semen samples from a 30-year-old man being held at the Travis County Jail on burglary charges. Having been in custody on a $25,000 bond since December 5, 1986, this man had been charged with burglarizing a house on Hemphill Park across the street from the house Connie Jane Bibb shared with nine other women on the very night she was slain. There was also an attempted rape in the area about 2 weeks prior to Connie's murder, and this man was also suspected of that attack. It's unclear if this arrest is in any way related to the murder of Connie Bibb, or related to the Hyde Park rapist case for that matter, but the evidence the cops needed to convict the man, let alone charge him, was almost non-existent. Likely, tests showed that the blood and semen found at the scene did not match this man. Press coverage of the murder of Connie Jane Bibb abruptly stopped. The second publicly known sexual assault at the hands of the Hyde Park rapist is probably not only the second known to the Austin police, but they had kept the attacks quiet. Late on July 3, 1987, a year and a half after the first known assault, a young University of Texas law student returned to her home on Avenue G after a night out with friends, her usual Friday night routine. Immediately upon entering the duplex apartment, the Hyde Park rapist grabbed her from behind and told the young woman he had a gun as he handcuffed her hands behind her back. After gagging her, placing a pillowcase over her head, and binding her with a nylon cord, the man placed the student on her bed, bound her ankles to the bedposts, performed several other seemingly ritualistic tasks, and then raped her. The cops' continued silence undoubtedly put the public at great risk. No one knew, which meant no one could take precautions. Law enforcement also refused to disclose the number of survivors theorized to have been victimized by this man, both in between the first two publicly known rapes and to this day, in fact. But at least six rapes and attempted rapes have been attributed to the Hyde Park rapist. Some relatively recent blog posts put the total number of victims at around nine. Likely, the actual number is even larger. During this depraved criminal's reign of terror, the homicide rate in Austin was high, and at least one 1986 murder was at some point theorized to be at the hands of this person. But it became relatively clear in 1988 that the Hyde Park rapist was a weak, little man, after two would-be victims very easily fought off his attempts to assault them. That alone makes this still unidentified serial rapist an unlikely suspect in the murder of Connie Jane Bibb. She was ex-military and could have easily overpowered him. The fact that her killer jimmied the door open, whereas the Hyde Park rapist always entered through unlocked doors or windows when no one was home and lied in wait until they returned, that the serial assaulter and Connie's killer were the same person. But then again, some details of her slaying match the Hyde Park rapist's M.O. The depraved criminal attacked white, single women between the ages of 18 and 30, and almost always raped his victims on or near a holiday. Connie's murder, of course, was on Thanksgiving. As the press coverage of Connie Jane Bibb completely stopped, stories about the Hyde Park rapist had begun, but not in the papers or television news, and certainly not because police had decided to alert the public. Instead, it was word of mouth. Since some area women finally became aware, they were able to take precautions, like purchasing pistols, making sure their homes were locked up tight, forming night watch groups, and participating in self-defense training. When 18-year-old University of Texas student Tiffany Bruce was found dead in her home on October 22, 1990, Connie Jane Bibb's name came back up in the press, but only briefly. Tiffany's murder was much different than Connie's. She was shot 3 times by a man infatuated and obsessed with her. But still, Tiffany's violent death and the fact that the Austin American Statesman was finally reporting on the Hyde Park rapist had local women in fear. It wasn't until 2009 that Connie's name came back up in the newspaper, this time on a story about the 2 investigators who'd been working on her case since 1999, 10 years earlier. Austin Police Detective Scott Ellert and Travis County Assistant District Attorney Darla Davis took over the Connie Jane Bibb murder case upon the formation of the city's cold case unit. Until then, her case had still been assigned to Homicide Sergeant Hector Reveles, one of the original investigators. Detective Ellert seemed confident the case could be solved using advancements in forensic technology, DNA testing specifically, and even went so far as to say such advancements had already helped move the case forward. Both Davis and Ellert seemed to believe that someone was sitting on a key piece of information that might be the impetus for cracking Connie Bibb's murder case. A piece of information the individual has no idea is important. In the same article, Connie's sister voiced her lack of optimism. While she'd not given up hope completely, it was clear the woman found it difficult to believe the case will be solved. More recently, in 2015, Austin Homicide Detective Jay Swan said Connie's case file contains
tons of clues, but sometimes we just have to wait for the right person to surface.
Swan's comment, alongside Detective Ellert's in 2009 about technological advancements moving Connie's case forward, suggest a DNA profile has been identified and entered into the FBI's Combined DNA Indexing System, or CODIS, but has received no hit. Although her sister had been less than optimistic in 2009, there is reason for Connie's family to be hopeful today, in 2023. Though Connie Bibb was murdered just over a year before DNA would be used to obtain a conviction in the United States, DNA technologies are far more advanced now, and advancements such as forensic genetic genealogy can help provide detectives with the best lead they can possibly get when traditional DNA methods, specifically uploading an STR DNA profile into CODIS, have failed. If the Austin police are simply waiting for someone to come forward, perhaps enlisting the help of the media would be the way to go. But they have not done that. Fox 7 Austin's 2014 story about Connie Jane Bibb and Susan Lee Wolfe's slaying in 1980 was the last traditional news coverage of Connie's case. Her Thanksgiving 1986 murder remains relatively unknown to the public, including in the city in which it occurred, Austin. If you have any information about the murder of Connie Jane Bibb, please contact the Austin Police Cold Case and Missing Persons Unit through the department's homicide tip line at 512-477-3588 or by calling the Capital Area Crime Stoppers hotline at 512-472-8477. If you have not already, look for Gone Cold on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Gone Cold and looking for the Texas logo. If you'd like to support the show and get the episodes ad-free, go to patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. Thanks to all of you who support us there. It's a huge deal to us. If you're not in a position to help Gone Cold financially, but would like to in some other way, well, I've got just the thing. Leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes particularly helps Gone Cold's visibility. The more folks who find us and listen, the greater chance someone with information about a case hears the show and comes forward with what they know. Every little bit helps, and we appreciate y'all's support immensely, however you choose to give it. Sources for this episode can be found in the episode's show notes. Thanks for listening, y'all.